This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, November 2nd, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from Walton Arts Center, featuring a night of Latin jazz Friday, November 9th at 7 and 9 p.m. Multi-instrumentalist Jane Bunnett and Hilario Duran will be joined by Cuban percussionist Candido Camero for two shows in the Starlight Jazz Club. Tickets and more information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, we look at the possibility of Madison County going wet. Voters must decide for the first time in 66 years to allow the sale and manufacture of alcohol. Plus, conversations with two of our regular commentators. Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers tells us what's up in entertainment this weekend. And Michael Tilley from the City Wire discusses jobless rate numbers, Oklahoma's new open carry law, and more. But first, Springdale residents should be advised that construction will close through traffic on a section of Randall Wobey Lane tomorrow. Beginning at 8 a.m., crews with the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad will work on replacing the railroad grade crossing on the street. Regular traffic will be diverted to Huntsville Avenue, while truck traffic is asked to divert to Highway 412 between Highway 71B and 265. The work is expected to be completed by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Yesterday, we brought you a story about a successful food drive on the UA campus in Fayetteville. But students at the University of Arkansas campus in Fort Smith also completed a successful food drive last week. Members of the Criminal Justice Club at the university decided to raise food for the River Valley Regional Food Bank last month. Dennis Williams is the club's faculty sponsor. He says the idea for the food drive came about after hearing a local news report in September about the food bank running low on supplies.
So they were trying to do a week of food drives and raise donations through that. I saw that, and as I became advisor, because this is my first year at UAFS, I was appointed advisor of the club, so I brought that to the club, and the kids were really enthusiastic about doing it. We got it going as quickly as we could, which would be about the first of October.
Williams says the food drive, which ended October 25th, was a sizable success.
The food bank pointed out that, you know, the 1,100 pounds, they said their citywide food drives only raise about 2,000. And they said that UAFS is always doing food drives for them, but this one came in with quite a bit of food, more than average.
He says the food drive was a good experience for members of the Criminal Justice Club, as many of the students who pursue a career in criminal justice will be faced with community service in their careers. The Washington County Jail may soon have more medical staff on hand, though if County Sheriff Tim Helder sees his plan to fruition, that staff would be contracted out by a third party. Helder says his plan would involve hiring an independent agency specialized in inmate health care, and that agency would be responsible for hiring and administering medical staff at the jail. Helder says hiring a company that is experienced in administering health care for inmates would help fill gaps in the medical screening system currently in place at the jail.
We've got three nurses, LPNs, and we've got one doctor that comes in once a week to see the detainees that the nurses have referred for his evaluation. What this program would do, it would spread that out to where we would have, if not 24-hour, 7-day-a-week coverage, very nearly that. It would not only be back in the pods or the cell blocks, it would be in the booking area.
Helder says having a better medical presence in the jail would help jail employees catch more medical problems in the screening process, which would in turn cut down on the litigation filed against the sheriff's department.
We found ourselves increasingly before the magistrate and federal court, and the majority of those instances are related to filings on at least an accusation of failure to provide adequate medical attention. That's just becoming more and more prevalent, and we just feel like if we take the necessary steps to try and become better and to get more experts on board, that it will help us in those areas, that if we are sued, that there's less likelihood of a successful outcome on the behalf of a plaintiff.
Because hiring a third party to manage and hire additional medical staff would require adjustment to the jail's budget, Helder's plan still requires approval from the county's quorum court. Helder says the current budget for medical staff at the jail is about $625,000, and the estimated cost for hiring outside help would cost between $850,000 and $900,000. He proposes making up the difference by using surplus money from the jail's food budget line item. Helder says the Quorum Court has increased the food budget by about 10% in anticipation of a growing jail population, but the line item has resulted in more than $200,000 in surplus for the past few years. Earlier this week, Source Gas Arkansas, which serves several hundred thousand natural gas customers in the state, filed its annual winter cost of gas adjustment with the Arkansas Public Service Commission. According to a press release issued by the company, a residential customer using 10,000 cubic feet of natural gas in a month can expect a decrease of about $4.44 on his or her monthly bill in comparison to last winter. The most recent cost of gas adjustment is 6.9% lower than the adjustment last winter, but is higher than the adjustment that was put in place this past summer. Rich Davis is the manager of community and government affairs for Source Gas Arkansas. He says that in both cases, the cost of gas was actually lower than it was with previous cost adjustments.
But because Source Gas is a publicly regulated utility, and we're regulated by the Arkansas Public Service Commission, the commission periodically does an earnings review on all utilities who have a tariff in place. The reason they conduct that review is that our tariff tells us how much we can earn, return on investment, return on equity. And as a result of the earnings review, the commission determined that we were over-earning, so we reduced our delivery charges to reflect that over-earning that the commission identified.
Davis says regardless of the price of natural gas, the company encourages its customers to strive for efficiency in their homes. He says for consumers to cut energy costs in the winter, they should use common sense strategies such as setting the thermostat at a slightly lower temperature, weatherizing windows and doors, and even by making sure the most efficient heating appliances are installed in your home. A statewide information network providing telemedicine and distance learning for healthcare and educational institutions will soon expand into Washington County. The University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences yesterday announced a partnership with Washington Regional Medical Center in Fayetteville, a partnership that will extend the Arkansas E-Link network to the hospital and 11 other sites in the county. According to a release by UAMS Arkansas, E-Link connects 413 community institutions of health to provide real-time exchange of patient data and readings, as well as video conferencing between medical professionals, patients, doctors, and others. Rollout of the expansion will be complete as soon as personnel at the hospital and individual clinics finish training with the new equipment and systems. The expansion means that E-Link will have a presence in all 75 Arkansas counties. In Razorback news, the UA swimming and diving team is ranked 21st nationally in the first College Swimming Coaches Association of America poll. The ranking puts the team against six other SEC teams that are also ranked nationally. The team will next compete in the Houston Cougar Swimming and Diving Invitational in Houston, Texas, where the Razorbacks will face fourth-ranked Texas A&M and number 17 LSU. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly clear skies in northwest Arkansas and partly cloudy skies in the River Valley, with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow, there is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. throughout the listening area. Expect partly to mostly sunny skies, with a high between 68 and 75 degrees. Tomorrow evening, there is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas and a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the Arkansas River Valley. Expect mostly cloudy skies with a low around 40 in northwest Arkansas and a low around 52 in the River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley, editor and publisher of the City Wire, covering news, entertainment, politics, culture, and more for the KUAF listening area. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm well.
First of all, let me say happy anniversary. You guys celebrated your fourth anniversary yesterday?
Yes, we did. November 1st, 2008, we rolled this little City Wire thing out, and we've been doing it for 4 years.
Can you believe it?
Well, no, it seems like one long day. I hope at some point I get to go to bed. No, we've enjoyed it, and we appreciate very much all the advertisers and sponsors and readers. Our traffic continues to grow. We're up a little over 30% on our visitors for the first 9 months of the year of 2012. So just keeping our fingers crossed, just keep your head down and work hard.
Sounds like a good plan. Now, part of over the last couple of years, actually this year, you guys expanded your coverage from the River Valley to include Northwest Arkansas as well. And you have some jobless rate numbers for me this morning for both areas.
Yes. The good news is in Northwest Arkansas, the jobless rate fell below 5%. It hit 4.9%. That's the first time since November 2008 that the rate has been below 5% in Northwest Arkansas.
Maybe it has something to do with your anniversary celebration.
No. Yeah, I'd like to take credit for that. But it's a trend across the state. All of the 8 metro areas that are in or connected to Arkansas had jobless rate declines in September. Unfortunately, in Northwest Arkansas, the rate's still pretty high. It was at 7.6%.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing with both markets is that the number of unemployed continues to fall month over month and year over year. So, we'll just keep our fingers crossed that these numbers come down. I'm a little surprised in the Fort Smith area that the numbers I guess another way to look at that is that metro jobless rate in the Fort Smith area is good considering the number of manufacturing losses we've suffered in the last 2 to 5 years.
Right, with Whirlpool and all of that.
Right. So it's holding its own. Now, you know, that doesn't tell the whole picture. You know, are we replacing, those good-paying manufacturing jobs with lower-paying service sector jobs? You know, that will come out in income data about a year from now.
Okay, so a year from now we can look at that.
Right. Doesn't do us any good now.
But. No, but something to look forward to.
Right.
Arkansas Best Corporation, they have reported their third quarter numbers.
Yes, at least they were positive. But Arkansas Best, which is a less-than-truckload company, it's one of the largest less-than-truckload carriers in the country.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yep, based here in Fort Smith. They reported a third quarter income of $6.5 million. It's down from the $12.3 million they reported in the same period of 2011. The good news is, though, they're back in black, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
For the first 9 months of the year, they're on the positive side of the income rather than the negative side. So, they were at this time last year they were almost $5 million in the hole, and this year they're ahead just a little bit. But the revenue is up. But this is just a function, again, of the slow freight environment, the tough freight environment around the country. You know, the American Trucking Association, they put out a truck tonnage index,
mm-hmm.
And the index has just been relatively flat for the whole year, and it basically measures freight demand. And their September increase was the smallest year-over-year gain in almost 3 years, so... it's tough. Arkansas Best is in the middle of, will begin union negotiations December 18th. They've had trouble with the unions, and they've cut costs everywhere they can, but they just can't cut on those union contracts. So they hope to get a little bit of expense relief from that. But the unions are saying, hey, you know, we have good drivers providing good service, and they deserve all the pay they get. So that'll be an interesting drama to watch as it unfolds.
How long do those negotiations usually take? Is that something that's done
well,
in a day?
Their contract expires at the end of March next year, so they're going to want, neither party can afford a shutdown. So they'll either have it secured by then or they'll secure some form of extension, I would think.
Okay. Now... we do have some listeners in Oklahoma, and I know you guys cover some things there as well. In Oklahoma, their open carry law went into effect yesterday.
Yes. This kind of snuck up on us. We'd covered it earlier when they had when Oklahoma had passed the bill. But,
mm-hmm.
Yes, it's if you're walking around Oklahoma, and you just happen to see non-uniformed or non-police officer folks walking around with a sidearm, in a holster or whatever, don't be alarmed.
Mm-hmm.
That's now legal. There are some exceptions. And you have to have a concealed weapon permit. You have to go through the process. Not just anyone can carry it.
Right.
But, and you can't carry it into schools and businesses that don't allow it. There's still some of those rules. But, yes, it's went into effect November 1st. There are an estimated 141,000 residents in Oklahoma who have the right now to do this, mm-hmm. and I think that's going to increase. Oklahoma officials have said they've estimated about a 40% increase in the number of residents who've applied for some form of a weapons permit since the law was passed. So, and the state's one of 44 that allows some kind of open carry law. But, you know, and then this is a big issue. There are some groups around who really see carrying a weapon as a constitutional right, and they don't think that they need a law to allow them to do that. But that's a different conversation altogether.
Well, what initially spurred getting this bill passed?
Was there a
specific incident or something?
No, it's just that there are several groups around the country who they try this in every state. In 2011, there was an attempt tried by Representative Denny Altus of Fort Smith to get a similar bill passed in Arkansas, and it never made it out of committee. So, yeah, I would be surprised if we don't see some form of a bill like this proposed in this upcoming legislative session in Arkansas.
Now, on the City Wire, you guys cover lots of things, but you do have some guest commentators. I know Cameron Smith had an interesting story for you guys this week.
Yes, it's a great history in about 1,000 words of the shifts that we've seen in the supplier community in terms of their history. One of the there are roughly 6,000 people working in Northwest Arkansas who are suppliers who support, you know, essentially Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And Cameron Smith does a great job of walking through what the skill sets will be needed now to help Walmart as it grows. You know, he talks about how a few years ago Walmart, you know, their main competitor was Target, and then it kind of moved to Dollar General, and now it's Amazon.
Really?
Yes, and so he says if the way that you worked with Walmart and helped them if you were a supplier in the past is going to change. And he talks about the millennial generation. You know, anyone born between 1980. He says anyone born between 1980 and 2000. Well, by 2025, those people will make up 75% of the workforce and 75% of the workforce of the Walmart supplier community. Those folks are more digital oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously we know they're walking around with two or three mobile devices, but he walks us through, there was a proximity relationship with Walmart, then there was a data relationship, then the insight relationship, and now it's a digital relationship. And he sees that happening at least out till 2020. So anyone even remotely curious about that, the evolving relationship between Walmart and its suppliers, I think they'll find this guest commentary very interesting.
All right. Well, again, congratulations on your 4 years of the City Wire. All the best in the future. And as always, thank you for your updates on these Fridays.
Well, you're welcome. And I enjoy it and enjoy working with you and Kyle. That helps get the City Wire word out. So thanks and have a good weekend. And go Hogs.
Yes, go Hogs. And thank you. Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of the City Wire, which covers news, entertainment, politics, culture, and more for Northwest Arkansas and the Arkansas River Valley.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, I air the long-awaited interview with Ernest Guitar Roy. He talks about his influences growing up in the Delta, his new CD, and he even plays a track for us here in the KOF studios. That's the Generic Blues Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. Voters in several dry Arkansas counties this election will be asked to consider permitting the sale and manufacture of alcohol. One of them is rural Madison County. The controversial issue is not only causing a spike at the polls, it's providing a big lesson in civic engagement. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Madison County Courthouse is humming with activity this general election as clerks and law enforcement guide early voters to their polling stations. Farron Ledbetter, county clerk, says this election cycle's been unusually busy.
We know our voter registration went up quite a bit the last couple of months, and we feel like that it was due to the wet-dry issue here in Madison County. I think people were registering not only so they could sign the petition, some of them, but also so they could have a say in it. And it is an emotionally charged issue. And, you know, folks have strong opinions and strong beliefs on both sides, and they're very sincere with their beliefs. And I think because of that, they're going to turn out and vote and have their say.
The county now counts 8,900 registered voters, and Farron Ledbetter expects 1,500 to vote early this year, new records. The man behind the alcohol measure is Bob Barton, a longtime resident of Kingston.
And I guess I'm a political activist now.
Barton, who's semi-retired and never initiated a political thing in his life, is president of the registered political group Keep Money in Madison County.
A little over 2 years ago, when the main subject in the county was replacing our jail, which is pretty much falling down around us, and I couldn't understand why the county was ignoring a potential source of revenue through the alcohol sales.
Barton said alcohol tax revenue, for example, could help to repair the courthouse and improve the jail. So with help of 50 different canvassers, starting last February, Barton collected 4,400 signatures, 3,400 of them valid, more than enough to get on the ballot. Keep Money in Madison County has also raised $10,200, not bad for a county of 16,000 residents with a median household income of $36,000 and a poverty rate at nearly 20%.
Madison County doesn't really have any kind of a centralized electronic media outlet. There's no radio stations here and there's no TV stations. We really didn't do any of that kind of advertising. It was more being out in public, our drive up and sign up events that we did this summer were pretty helpful. It eventually came down to door-to-door canvassing was really what got the signatures.
Door-to-door in a rural mountain county can't be easy, but the results are clear. Red and white yard signs are everywhere suggesting to vote wet, and they can be seen along forest roads and farm fields.
If this measure passes this time on this ballot, it'll be very historic, because most counties that go from dry to wet, they go through the process at least a couple of times.
But many other homes have posted signs in opposition, organized by Citizens to Keep Madison County Safe. The group, which has raised $2,000 so far, is even displaying a wrecked car to vividly illustrate the potential effects of drunk driving. Spokesperson Diana Edmondson.
Because if this measure should pass, it will only bring more suffering and anguish to citizens of Madison County. No good can come of this.
Voters in Marion County and Benton County, home to Walmart, the world's largest retailer, with more than 1,000 global suppliers within its 30-mile radius, are also deciding to allow alcohol sales. The group pushing for it in Benton County is Keep Dollars in Benton County, financed by two wealthy Walton family offspring who've donated $330,000 for professional canvassing and political advertising. But Bob Barton says Keep Money in Madison County has been a grassroots effort.
We're a lot cheaper per signature out here in Madison County, I guarantee you.
Benton County organizers also had enough campaign loot to pay for an economic study showing potential revenue from alcohol sales, an estimated $1.5 million in city sales tax, primarily from Rogers and Bentonville, with labor income to open retail stores calculated at more than $15 million, creating more than 500 jobs. But Madison County organizers could never afford to pay for such a study. Again, Bob Barton.
I think, you know, eventually we came to the realization that the revenue increases in the county were going to be more important to the private industry than they were to private individuals and businesses than to the county. And quite frankly, I think that's the way it ought to be.
In recent decades, Madison County residents have been forced to travel to Washington and Carroll County, and more recently to Boone County to purchase alcohol. Madison County's been dry since 1946. But if voters agree, and once the election is certified and clears any appeals, beer and wine permits for off-premises sales, meaning carryout, will be made available. Applying for a liquor store license, which are limited by population count, is much more time-consuming. But three such stores could be permitted in Madison County, bringing potential new revenue. But again, Diana Edmondson, who's campaigning against the issue, disagrees.
People need to understand that we may see an increase in revenue in the beginning, but over the long haul, statistics prove that it actually goes down. But yet the emotional costs that are involved with families, the deterioration of the family unit, by making alcohol more accessible, it just increases more pain and anguish in the lives of family members.
Madison County's dry status is a remnant of the Federal Volstead Act of 1920, which outlawed alcohol sales and consumption nationwide. Although prohibition was repealed 13 years later during the Great Depression, thousands of counties across the South have remained dry, including 40 of Arkansas's 75 counties. But the climate appears to be changing. In the 2010 midterm election, Boone County voted by 53% in favor of retail alcohol sales. The county seat, Harrison, has seen a spike in sales tax revenue and tourism, along with a slight increase in public drunkenness, but not crime, a city official told our news bureau last summer. Matt Shelnut, editor and general manager of the weekly Madison County Record, has captured the brunt of public opinion.
Well, it's very divisive, as you might imagine. There have been a lot of passionate letters to the editor and just general comments on both sides.
And Shelnut thinks the final tally will be close.
As far as whether it's going to pass or not, you know, we did an informal, very unscientific poll on our website. And the majority of people who voted in that particular poll were for it going wet. And also, you know, Bob Barton, in the petition process, he got so many signatures that were thrown out because the people who signed them didn't realize that they were actually not registered. So you have to think that a lot of those people in the meantime are going to become registered or are obviously have already become registered. So if those numbers hold up, the total number of signatures he got was close to 50%.
This month, Matt Shelnut wrote and published a three-part series on the issue.
People thought, I guess, is that when we did that series, you know, speaking from our standpoint, is they thought we were trying to change people's minds, but there is no way that you're going to change anybody's mind. We just wanted to better inform people, our readers, about here's what if the county does go wet, here's the potential revenue, here's the potential legal situations, where liquor stores could be located, things of that nature. So we spoke with state officials, and then here are other counties that have made the transition and crime rates and economic benefit.
Matt Shelnut's readers also learned some local history. Legitimate whiskey distilleries were big business in Madison County in the late 19th century, as were drinking saloons. That is until Congress levied costly licensure and high whiskey taxes. That prompted a surge in moonshining across the Ozarks. And Kingston native David Russell, vice president of Keep Money in Madison County, says bootlegging is still a huge problem in the county, especially for underage drinkers.
I don't deal with them. I don't know who they are, but you know, you hear the stories. You know, there's still people selling beer in the county too. And I don't think they card anyone. I don't think they're very care who what age they are, or as long as they got the money. And so that's still a problem.
And David Russell says voting wet will lift the local economy.
I think it'll be good for the county. It'll help some of our local merchants and keep some of the money in the county. Plus, when you go out of the county, not only maybe to buy beer, you may fill up your car, you may eat in another county. So I think it'll keep more of the money in the county.
As for Bob Barton, who's leading this wet campaign, he says exercising his political right as an American citizen has been amazing and fulfilling.
You know, it feels good. Honestly, regardless of the outcome on November 7th, we really want the county to go wet, but just giving the people an opportunity to vote on it was, you know, if we don't win, that'll still be enough.
But if it passes, Bob Barton, an avid home brewer, might, he said, open up a brew pub with the moniker Booger Brewing Company. He was kidding about the name. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday afternoon, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, came by the Susan and Anthony Hoy News Studio to talk to Kyle and I about what's up in entertainment this weekend, as well as assess the post-fundraiser state of our station.
There's nothing sadder than coming in here and whining about being tired to these people. Are you saying that post-fundraiser we look a wee bit tired?
A little disheveled around the edges, but successful.
Yes.
Very successful.
Yes.
There's another fundraiser coming up on Thursday that's shorter and smaller and really fun.
And that is in Springdale?
That is in Springdale. It's the 5x5 Jazz Soiree and Silent Auction. And Zeke Taylor is one of the artists this year.
5x5 is one of your favorite events that happens.
It is, and one of Antoinette's, too.
I enjoy going with you. And every year I mean to make something, and then I remember I'm really not that creative.
And every year I mean to make something, and, well, you know. But you know Zeke Taylor from Eureka Springs is wildly creative.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If you don't know who he is, gee, how can you explain Zeke? He paints monkeys, anthropomorphic monkeys. There's no great reason for that except that he was working for a decorator pillow company and they asked him to design a chimp in clothes.
There you go.
And it's been wildly successful. This year he has done a 5x5 that includes a little chimp holding a sock monkey. That's the small of it. The pig of it is that he's also done a pig for the Ozark Literacy Council's Pigsibition Public Art Project. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about something that's 5 inches by 5 inches and something that he describes as it seemed like it was as big as a Volkswagen.
They're like 6 feet, from what I understand, from like tail to tip, probably.
Launching. It appears that they're jumping into space.
Yes.
And they are so big, he said, that he had to get on a stepladder and that he had to paint it in his driveway because he couldn't get it through the door.
Right.
Where is the pig that he created? Where
his
is, it
is at Powerhouse Seafood and Grill
That's
in Fayetteville.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's called the Pig Easy. And it's even clear-coated like a car.
Is this the one that's like kind of Mardi Gras-esque, the purple? Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
And so you can go see his pig. Then you can go see his work at the Jazz Soiree. And this weekend, since it's homecoming, there's a whole bunch of pigs you can go see.
That's right.
So first of all, the Jazz Soiree and 5x5 auction is Thursday evening at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. It starts at 5:55 and lasts till 7:55. It's $10 at the door. And I promise, if I want something, you and I'll go down.
It's a silent auction.
It's a silent auction.
And
but viciousness sometimes ensues.
Right.
They do it for an art center in Fort Smith, and people run for the one they want, which sounds even more terrifying.
Dangerous.
Well, this one seems a little more, when you put it like that, this one seems
a little
safer.
More civilized.
A little more civilized.
Yes.
Because the 5x5s hang on the wall, and then you can write down your number, your name, by how much you
want
to bid
it's
for.
It's just the standing in front of the one you want and glaring it.
Right.
It gets
a little vicious at the end.
Now, if you want to go see pigs, here are some places you can see them. Priscilla White's Pick Up a Book and Read is at the Arvest Bank on the Fayetteville Square.
And it's a wonderful pig.
It is.
Mel Thompson's Pigtopia is at Destinations at 3849 Weddington Drive in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. Ferdinand the Bull Pig by Carol Sherris is at the BHK Cafe on the Fayetteville Square.
Right outside.
Jack Wilson's When Pigs Fly, and it's beautiful, is at Drake Field in Fayetteville. It's painted like an aviator cow.
I haven't seen that yet.
Sweet Pea by Margot Moulton is at
that one is
the
fabulous.
Walton Art Center in the Rose Garden. The Reader by Jason Jones is at CertaPro Painters on North College. Mm-hmm. Anair by Adam Campbell is east of George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville.
Right along the trail.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful Fayetteville by Ray Russell is at the Clinton House Museum. Freedom by Hisekomura Yale is at the Ozark Literacy Council in Fayetteville, sponsors of this whole thing. Suey Student, love this one, by Jane Garrison Davidian is at the Inn at Carnell Hall, and the back shows buildings on campus. And he's a pig best seen from behind. Pigatol by Matt Miller is at Cox Communications on Futrell Drive. Zeke's Pig Easy is at Powerhouse Seafood, as we said. Ball Hog by Michael Marzullo is at Pinnacle Foods.
Okay.
Priscilla, also by Michael Marzullo, is at Mermaids. And When Pigs Fly by Ronnie Sparkman is at the library right across from us. It's a beautiful pig.
Yeah, just that one just got there not too long ago.
Mm-hmm. Is that all of them? Or are we expecting some more?
There's supposed to be more. This is like 17 or 18. Okay. There's supposed to be 25 total.
Okay.
So
I keep checking to see when they're all out there.
Yes, they're not all there yet.
Okay.
But figuring it was homecoming weekend at the university, it was a good time to go look
at
pigs. Also this weekend, the world premiere of a new drama by Oren Softy, Checks and Balances. Mm-hmm. 8 o'clock today and tomorrow, 2 o'clock Sunday at Rogers Little Theater. Tickets start at $16, $10 for students. Later Life wraps up this week at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. Shows at 7:30 tonight and tomorrow night only. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is on at the Berry Performing Arts Center at JBU in Siloam Springs, 7:30 today and tomorrow. Tickets start at $10. Shrek continues its run at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. What fun we had Halloween. Mm-hmm. They had trick-or-treating. They had cast members out in a costume parade with the kids. Great fun. Showtimes are 8 o'clock today, 2 and 8 tomorrow, and 2 and 7:30 Sunday, and tickets start at $39. And my favorite band in the world, Trout Fishing in America, performs at 7:30 tonight at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium, and at 1 tomorrow at Basin Spring Park as part of the Folk Festival in Eureka Springs. And the headliner is Ronnie Cox at 7:30 Saturday.
Sounds like fun.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. In the 1930s, two preachers, Owen Whitfield and Claude Williams, used the power of their traveling pulpits to organize workers across the country. One black, one white, the men saw it as their Christian duty to help workers be able to live decent lives. In the new dual biography, The Gospel of the Working Class, Labor's Southern Prophets in New Deal America, two historians, Eric Gelman and Jared Rodd, investigate the lives of the two preachers. The two historians recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the book.
Eric was completing a dissertation on the National Negro Congress, very urban-focused research. I was working on sharecroppers and tenant farmers in the Missouri Boot Heel, very rural. We both encountered this man, Owen Whitfield, in our respective research and started talking about it, and the project really grew from there.
So was it, Eric, as simple as the two of you kind of realized you both had come across this
well,
character?
It started off as a question. Owen Whitfield kept coming up in these different contexts, and neither of us, because we studied urban history and rural history respectively, could really make sense of him. So he was going over the boundaries of what historians normally do. And it wasn't until we started talking to each other, usually over a beer, after classes ended or after our research days, that we started putting this together.
And Owen Whitfield is a dramatic historic personality, like very few others.
Yeah, I mean, he was so charismatic. One thing that a number of people recalled, and you know, we just came from the Boot Heel area 2 days ago where we spent some time with two of Owen Whitfield's daughters, was that you had to hear him preach to understand his power. Unfortunately, we never heard him preach, but we do have lots of transcripts, and we're able to unearth all these interesting sermons from various places to see how he would approach ordinary people and speak to them on terms that they could understand and then really transform them and empower them to act.
He was often preaching, a deeply religious man, and often preaching, and I'm going to make this too simple, so please fill in the preaching that hard work should mean a good life. I mean, that's a basic tenet that he would say.
Yeah, it came out of his upbringing in the rural South, in rural African American families. His family, he was the son of sharecroppers in eastern Mississippi. They worked hard, and they did so in order to try to buy land. They didn't want to escape. They wanted to escape a plantation, but they wanted to escape it to a farm of their own. And what guided that process was a belief that hard work should yield earthly reward. And that comes right out of Scripture, and it was a central component of rural African-American religion and rural African-American belief in an agrarian future, that landed autonomy, land ownership, independence, a self-sustaining economic unit on a farm was what they were aiming for in the future. And Owen Whitfield
pursued that throughout his life.
Heaven on earth.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. But, you know, fulfilling the biblical injunction that, you know, you eat out of the sweat of your brow, mm-hmm. right, that you have to work.
Right.
Right. But when you do work, you do get that reward. So it is fulfilling biblical duty or divine duty, but also making sure that you receive the other side of that.
Owen Whitfield is one half of this story. Claude Williams, the other, also a preacher, but Claude Williams is white.
Yes, similarly, Claude Williams was born into a family of sharecroppers who had to work other people's land to get by. He was from Weakley County of Tennessee, and similar to Owen Whitfield, started to increasingly question why so much hard work was going unrewarded. And what's interesting about Williams and Whitfield is that they had such similar upbringings, yet they were on the opposite sides of the color line, that Jim Crow had dictated that while their experiences were so similar, they were kept so separate from each other.
It's hard to understate the passion that these individuals had for organizing union and trying to bring up people like them to a livable wage. I mean, as you mentioned, this was not necessarily always a popular message to bring. It could be dangerous. But reading about them, you get the idea that they felt they had no choice, that this was something they were put on this planet to do.
It's rooted in religious conviction. You know, this is not partisan politics. This is not, you know, a world of compromise and getting the best deal possible and pragmatism. They are fervent believers. They are idealists, and they are driven by that religious conviction to do what, you know, at the time looks like very risky and crazy things to do, to be honest. It's that religious conviction that drives them throughout, which also leads to problems with them when they're working with various allies in the Democratic Party or the Socialist Party or the various unions they're working with. It's difficult for them to compromise their idealistic conviction, their sense of religious conviction and mission with the world, the petty world of politics in the New Deal era.
Yeah, their mission seemed to be a big tent. We're all in this together. But as you say, because they attracted so many different types politically or socially or of skin color, there were problems getting that big final united front.
Absolutely. I mean, they're working in a political context that at heart is deeply sectarian, socialists, communists, liberals, Southern Democrats, African Americans, where those political divisions matter. And they're coming from a religious conversion, a religious conviction that stresses ecumenical cooperation across denominational boundaries. That's where they both start, is trying to break down false divisions between Christians to try to get at the truth or the essence of Christ's message. And they take that ecumenical religious mission into this very non-ecumenical political world and really confront it with that.
And in the case of some of the unions they work with, there's this grudging acceptance of their tactics, and the union leaders see it as a tactic, whereas they see this as a form of belief because it's so effective at organizing workers and reaching workers and landless Americans who previously had been seen as unreachable. So that's, you know, why these liberal groups or other groups embraced this network of a kind of radical gospel. It became a problem, though, too, because when you have these strong convictions and you're working with allies who are often pragmatic and see short-term goals as more important or institutional survival as more important than what happens, right? And so a lot of the networks that they interact with end up expelling them or casting them aside or trying to minimize the impact of their larger vision for the sake of more pragmatic and short-term goals.
There's a lot of idealism working here, and this is fascinating because you see what happens when idealism can meet petty realism at times. But they were effective, and one reason is because they were so charismatic and so good at oration. What would it be like if we had gone to hear Whitfield or Williams speak?
Well, one part of the book that we sort of excerpt is the first time the two of them met. which is a kind of fascinating story. I believe it was November 1936 in a small church in Krosno, Missouri. This was a church that Whitfield was preaching in at the time. And Whitfield at this point still believed in a kind of black nationalism that came from the 1920s. It came from a distrust of whites and his own experiences growing up in the Jim Crow South. And some of his congregants approached Claude Williams and another organizer for the Southern Tenant Farmers Union named E.B. McKinney and asked them to come to the church and talk about this new union idea. Largely out of desperation during the Great Depression, they were open-minded to new ideas. And Whitfield only very reluctantly agreed to host these gentlemen in his church, especially because Claude Williams was white. And, you know, he made this famous remark. Jared, help me out here.
Well, Whitfield said that Williams, his sermon, gave it to them with both barrels. And that kind of forceful blood and thunder, evangelical sermonizing. So the form is usual, is the usual evangelical form that the congregation is expecting. But the content is so radical and so different from what they'd heard before that virtually every account we have of people hearing them preach come away just blown away by these guys. And that's part of the reason why they're so successful, especially among rural Southerners in the rural South, and rural Southerners who end up going to cities like Memphis or Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and ultimately Detroit, is that here are these guys speaking their language, but they're speaking, you know, the words they're saying are so radically different, but so immensely powerful and relevant to the current struggles they're going through as they make this transition from working the land to working for wages in southern factories and in northern factories.
Absolutely. And that first meeting they had was actually one where Williams' preaching style convinced a very skeptical Whitfield, who was in the audience, that this was the true nature of activism and this was the way out of the Great Depression, and it was so connected to the gospel that going in, Whitfield said, that Peckerwood's got nothing to say to me, meaning, you know, that white right. guy, right? What's he going to say? But coming out of it, they formed this unique partnership that would last for the next decade in working in a way that was interracial and working in a way that reached out to both African-American workers as well as disenfranchised and poor white workers.
Historians Eric Gelman and Jared Rodd are the authors of The Gospel of the Working Class, Labor's Southern Prophets in New Deal America. They recently spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about their new dual biography.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 2nd of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1948, that Harry S. Truman managed one of the great election upsets in history. He beat the governor of New York, the Republican Thomas Dewey, for the presidency. Truman had been doing badly in the polls. He'd come into office after Franklin Roosevelt's death in April 1945. He'd never really lived up to Roosevelt's reputation. He was not well known. Republicans had taken control of the Congress in the midterm elections, 1946. Factions of the Democratic Party were splitting off into the Progressive Party and the Dixiecrats. 2 months before the election, the pollster Elmo Roper announced he was going to stop surveying voters because Truman was so far behind. But Harry Truman set out on his whistle-stop tour, private railroad car with a sound system so he could pull into small towns and give speeches. And that fall of 1948, he traveled almost 22,000 miles and delivered more than 300 speeches, including the first speech ever delivered by an American president to a black audience in Harlem. On election day, he went to bed early after a ham sandwich and a glass of milk, woke up around midnight, turned on the radio. They reported that he was ahead in the popular vote by more than 1 million, but the announcer said that Truman was still undoubtedly beaten. It turned out, though, that he had won 303 electoral votes to Thomas Dewey's 1989. Not a single news organization in the country had predicted the election correctly. And a couple days later, Truman posed with a copy of the Chicago Tribune with the headline, "Dewey Defeats Truman," and a big grin on his face. It's the birthday of the frontiersman Daniel Boone, born 1734 near Reading, Pennsylvania. Daniel Boone, who said, "I have never been lost, but I will admit to being confused for several weeks." And it was on this day, 1889, North Dakota and South Dakota became the 39th and 40th states of the Union. The population of each state about the same now as it was almost a century ago. South Dakota, home to half of the wild buffalo left in America, North Dakota still the least visited state in the nation. Here's a poem for today by Barbara Howes, entitled "Early Supper." Laughter of children brings the kitchen down with laughter, while the old kettle sings, laughter of children brings to a boil all savory things. Higher than beam or rafter, laughter of children brings the kitchen down with laughter. So ends an autumn day. Light ripples on the ceiling. Dishes are stacked away. So ends an autumn day. The children jog and sway in comic dances, wheeling. So ends an autumn day. Light ripples on the ceiling. They trail upstairs to bed, and night is a dark tower. The kettle calls. Instead, they trail upstairs to bed, leaving warmth, the coppery red mood of their carnival hour. They trail upstairs to bed, and night is a dark tower. Early Supper, a poem by Barbara Howes from her collection Light and Dark, published by Wesleyan University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF is provided by White River Nursery, offering a variety of pansies and mums for color, plus native trees and shrubs for fall planting. Open Tuesday through Saturday, located on East Huntsville Road in Fayetteville near Lake Sequoia. 442-2061 or whiterivernursery.com for more information. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Waldron. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in on Sunday for Weekend Ozarks at Large. That's Sundays at 9. And I will be back on Monday at noon with an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks again for listening, and have a fantastic weekend.